This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll talk about what could be the end of L.A. Swift, the bus route from Baton Rouge to New Orleans, which more than 12,000 riders have used on a monthly basis. We'll talk about where it goes from here. The program costs $2.3 million to operate, and state lawmakers and the governor decided in their wisdom during the last session that the state may not be able to meet the cost. We'll talk with Councilwoman Tara Wicker about this and more. Also, Daniel Bergner. His book is What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. Daniel Bergner's book is the talk of the nation. Front page of the New York Times Book Review yesterday. We'll talk with him about his controversial subject matter. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757, and you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our leadoff guest is Tara Wicker, the councilwoman from District 10, which spans from the gates of LSU to the gates of Southern, includes downtown, and also includes the terminal where L.A. Swift comes and goes. And since 2006, this has served as a post-Katrina recovery transportation to help displaced residents rebuild their homes and livelihoods. And more than 12,000 riders have used the service on a monthly basis. And with us to begin the discussion, before we get to Councilwoman Wicker, is Dustin Anison from the Department of Transportation. Good morning to you, Dustin.
Morning, Jim.
Well, where does this stand as far as state funding right now?
Well, right now, the L.A. Swift is a primarily federally funded bus service. It's set to close, cease operations on June 30th when the federal funding for the program ends.
So you say it's primarily federal funding. How much is federal and how much is state?
The federal funding is about a little over $1.5 million. The state funding or local funding that would be required to match that funding this year is about $750,000.
So in order for the state to continue it, the state would have to pony up the $750,000 plus the $1.5 million, right?
Correct. No, actually, it would just be the $750,000 to get the $1.5 federal match. But it could be a state or a local entity could take over the service.
That's an important thing. So basically, the state has decided not to do the $750,000, and that by virtue of that, the federal funding goes away.
Correct. There's no funding for the service in the budget that's passed this year.
So this is a state issue, three-quarters of $1 million, a budget, of course, which is $25 billion or so. Why was the $750,000 not agreed to by lawmakers and the governor?
To be honest with you, I don't know. We've gone year to year by getting the federal funding from the feds. We tried again this year. It just happened to be that the funding wasn't included in the state budget.
It seems like pennies on the dollar, and if 12,000 riders are using the service on a monthly basis, according to my math, 12 times 12, that's 144,000 riders every year. That's a lot of people.
It is a good amount of people, but you're looking at an average of somewhere between 200 to 400 a day.
Well, is there any way to come through and save the day and find the $750,000 from another source? Would that do the job?
Well, yeah. Our contract with Hotard, who we contract to run the service, expires on June the 30th. If a local entity would like to enter into a contract and continue services starting July 1st, we'd be happy to work with them to share information on how to get it done.
All right. So if somebody comes through with $750,000, let's say producer Kevin Gallagher opens his checkbook, then that would conceivably do the job.
Yes, you could enter in a contract to continue the service.
All right, 297-5633, and we'll join Councilwoman Tara Wicker, whose district is right in the heart of this service, in just a moment. But Judy on I-10, who's been waiting patiently. Judy, good morning. You're the first caller for Dustin and Councilwoman Wicker. Hi, Judy.
Good morning. I'm going to say something that I almost never say. Getting rid of this program is so stupid, it's almost physically painful. You're dealing with a situation where a lot of people are getting back and forth to work, and I don't know why the state seems to be continually screwing the little guy, because they seem to think that the little guy is not the backbone of this state, and they really are. And I'm really hoping that this program can be saved, but I'm not optimistic because a lot of people aren't looking at the long term. Thank you.
All right. Dustin, your response?
Well, it's also important to note that we do have, there is another service, Greyhound out of Baton Rouge, that also provides a self-sustaining service between New Orleans and Baton Rouge. It's also an option.
But the cost of the L.A. Swift trip, it's not much, is it?
It's $5 each way.
$5 right. each way. If you take Greyhound, you're going to pay a little more than that, I would think.
Probably so. I'm really not sure exactly what the cost
well,
is.
I used to ride the bus to New Orleans to cover the Saints many years ago, and we're talking several years ago, and believe me, it was more than $5 a trip. 275-633 is your number, and we'll go return to the phone lines. I want to get Councilwoman Wicker on this subject as well. As I mentioned, her district represents Southern, LSU, downtown, and if you get on the L.A. Swift route, you get on it in her district. What's your take on how this affects the people in your backyard?
Well, good morning, and I think I absolutely have to concur with the last caller in regards to the fact that many people don't realize that how many individuals actually utilize this service to get to work. It's an economic tool for the community, for the state, and I think that getting rid of that is not a wise thing to do, in my opinion.
Do you think something can be done in the next 13 days to get the $750,000?
You know, I'm always hopeful that outside of government that we are able to look at the private sector, because many individuals that are utilizing these services are, you know, going to work at someone's business. Mm-hmm. So I really would hope that maybe the business community can get involved and tap in and say, hey, you know, we believe that this is a viable service as well, and we want to come to the table and play our role and help to fund it as well.
Mm-hmm. And one of our erudite listeners says Greyhound is a $50 round trip. So that's a difference between $10 and $50. And let's say you're going on the L.A. Swift to work, as right. some people do. It's one thing if it's $50 a week. It's another if it's $250 per week. Lynn and Melrose. Lynn, you're on the air with Dustin and Councilwoman Wicker. Hi, Lynn.
Good morning, Jim, and your guests. I posted an article about this last week. I find it strange that a fare increase has been ruled out apparently by DOCD, when in fact, if you pay $10 round trip, I estimate that if you bump that to $16, you would pay it would raise the other $750,000, and I think it's really short-sighted to disband this service with people, as the Councilman Wicker has already said. People are starting to get used to this. It's a clean service. It's got Wi-Fi on it. You can ride comfortably in New Orleans, and more professionals are doing that now, including my daughter, who comes to Baton Rouge to see her boyfriend. I think it's also a step in the direction of a rail service between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, and I would think that the Chambers of Commerce of both cities and other, the Department of Economic Development would be very interested. I'm just amazed that this is happening in kind of a vacuum with very little reaction.
All right. Dustin Anderson, would you like to respond?
Yeah, regarding the fare increase, that is something that was could be considered, but FTA regulations, which is where we get the funding from, they don't allow any increase in fare revenues to be applied toward that required local match. So you would still have to come up with the $750,000 to match the federal funds.
Well, it would seem that idea would work, but you're saying that you can't get the matching funds if you do it.
That's correct. For the regulations require a concrete source of funding, which would be the $750,000.
Okay. Well, Dustin, we thank you for joining us on short notice this
morning. No problem.
And I did talk with some people last week, and apparently the Baton Rouge Chamber, in the Center for Planning Excellence, many people in the community are working for some kind of an alternative, but the clock is ticking. In 13 days, the L.A. Swift goes away unless somebody finds $750,000. Thank you, Dustin.
All right, you're welcome. Okay.
And, of course, we'll continue with Councilwoman Tara Wicker. Rebecca in North Baton Rouge. Rebecca, you're on the air. Good morning to you.
Hi, great to be with you. I had a question about the allocation of the funds. Like, does it have to be a municipality or a parish that comes up with the money, or have they considered fundraising or crowdsourcing to try to come up with the $750,000? Because that doesn't seem like so much that you couldn't come up with it from the people to keep this going, because it's obviously a great asset.
Councilwoman?
You know, I think that having an opportunity to do some sort of a fundraising, of course, the idea is always sustainability. If you do the fundraising, you know, that it would have to be something that will be continuous. So, you know, outside of some dedicated source, you need to be able to make sure that you have something in place, because once individuals are accustomed to that service, you want to make sure that it's available to them long term. So that's just sort of the issue that we'd have to consider when you look at doing the fundraising piece. But I think it's a good idea as well.
Judy writes, why doesn't it go to the New Orleans airport? I would use it several times a year if it could get you to the airport, and would gladly pay more. Cost of parking for 2 days is more than the trip on L.A. Swift.
I think she's absolutely right. I mean, if we're able there are so many options that are available. I think that before this is taken away, that there needs to be a larger community conversation to say, you know, what are the options, what are available, because it is going to have a significant impact on so many people's lives. And I think that they'll be surprised at how many people are actually utilizing that service. Baton Rouge and New Orleans are getting closer and closer and closer, and I think we need to make sure transportation is involved in that conversation.
Charles in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Charles. You're on the air with Councilperson Tyra Wicker.
Well, good morning.
Morning.
I retired not long ago and worked for about 40 years, and nobody ever paid my way to work. So why should I pay somebody else's way to work? You know, that's what self-support is about. And as long as we enable people to rely on everybody else, then they don't gain independence.
But Charles, what if some of these people are dependent upon this service to have a job? Isn't it better that they're employed? Isn't that much less of a cost than have them unemployed and perhaps getting money from the government for unemployment?
I think it's wonderful that they're employed. Pay their way to work. Nobody ever paid my way to work. Why should I pay somebody else's way to work?
Well, the people do pay your way to work, because we pay for the roads, we pay for the police, we pay for a lot of things on your way to work.
That's right. It's called taxes. It's not called support. So, you know,
well,
I understand your viewpoint, and it's wonderful that people go to work. But, you know, when I was in college, I took the bus back to Chalmette, LSU. And, you know, nobody ever paid my way to go back home. I didn't, and believe me, back then, I wasn't making any money.
Plus, doesn't it help with pollution and global warming and all that stuff to have people in one bus rather than driving their cars and clogging the roads? And
you're absolutely right. I just want them to pay their own way to do that. That's
all right. Well, thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
I appreciate it. 297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757. And Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Dorothy in Goodwood. Hi, Dorothy. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. Is it possible that the city of New Orleans could come up with this money, or perhaps some of the parishes on the way down?
Well, I think the people who benefited from it most are in Baton Rouge and in New Orleans. Could it be a collaborative effort, perhaps by the metro councils of each entity? What do you think?
I think it's a great idea. I think that we were meeting with Adam Knapp from our Chamber of Commerce the other day, having the exact same conversation about the transportation situation between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, and how we may be able to work together more as a collaborative between the two cities and also the parishes in between. So I think it's a viable option. I think it's something that we definitely need to look at. I don't know the breakdown of that cost right now, but I do think that having those different entities involved at a higher level, somebody needs to be able to come to the table with that solution. I think it's a great idea.
What do you think will happen in the next 13 days? Is it going to be saved, or is it going to go away?
My prediction will probably be in the next 13 days, just because it's so close. I'm not really sure. I know that there's some individuals that are working very feverishly to try to make sure that it does not go away. My hope and my heart is that we'll be able to come up with some resolve, even if it's a one-time solution right now, to at least keep it going until we're able to develop a long-term solution, is my hope.
We'll return with Councilwoman Tyra Wicker, now in her second term. She represents an area that covers LSU, Southern, downtown, and all parts between, including L.A. Swift. We'll talk more with Councilwoman Wicker when we return on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. For the last 7 years, L.A. Swift has served as a post-Katrina recovery transportation to New Orleans and back, and it's $5 each way. And the cost to the state is $750,000 a year for 12,000 people a week taking this route. The government, in its wisdom, state government, decided it could not pony up the money this year. So if somebody doesn't come forward, some public entity or private one, the service goes away on July 1st. 297-5633 if you'd like to join the conversation with Councilwoman Tara Wicker. AJ says, I have a service dog, and sometimes the L.A. Swift is the only way I can travel back and forth. This, he writes, is just criminal to end this much-needed service. Much better use for transportation to the airport and some other matters that he addresses. But that's another example of somebody who's been dependent upon this service.
Wow. You know, I think we'll find that there's a huge diversity of individuals that utilize the system, this kind of system. And I know the other caller mentioned about individuals being able to pay. They are paying, you know, actually to utilize the service. But if there was an opportunity for a hike in a fare increase, mm-hmm. and there would be an opportunity for them to pay, and I'm sure there'll be individuals that would pay. There's a huge range of individuals that are utilizing these services. You know, individuals that are disabled, but also that people just that don't want to drive in that traffic, that would prefer to be able to read their newspaper, get on the internet while they're traveling.
Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on with Tara Wicker.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Councilwoman.
Good morning.
My question is, if the council could come up with $11 million in a loan to buy Woman's Hospital, and if Sharon Weston Broome could slip $1 million in the state budget to tear down Earl K. Loan, I don't understand why we can't come up with $750,000 to save a service as popular as it is in Baton Rouge and New Orleans.
All right.
That's an excellent point. I mean, you know, their budgets and their priorities in terms of spending, you know, and at some point we have to be able to determine, you know, what's going to be important and what's going to make sure that the larger community is supportive of that. There were individuals that were supportive of that purchase and individuals that were not. But when it comes to transportation, I personally believe that transportation is an economic engine for this community. And I believe that investing in that is a wise decision to make. So if there are opportunities for those funds to be found, which, to be honest with you, at this juncture, I don't see that happening. But if there are opportunities within the city budget to make that a priority, you know, I think that that may be something that we should look at. However, I think that, you know, in that it's a situation that started at the state, that the state's been actively involved in, I would really be looking for them to make more of an investment and more make this more of a priority as well.
Now, those who are the bean counters would note that this is not a one-time cost, that this is an annual cost that likely would go up year after year. But when you're putting down $750,000 and you get $1.5 million back from the federal government, it seems like the math works on that one.
You're absolutely right.
Well, the 12,000 people who use it, some of them are using it because they don't have cars. They need this. They're probably lower income than others. Do you think this is an assault on the poor?
You know, some would view it as an assault on the poor because, unfortunately, still in Baton Rouge, in parts of the state, we see transportation, public transportation, as something that is generally only used by the poor. But you mentioned it earlier. I mean, with our emission standards and globally, what's going on with our air system, we need to be able to be in a position of making sure that we're doing what's not only healthy for us as economically, but also for our climate, and making sure that we are doing what we're supposed to do. I think that it's something that we should invest in. I think that it's not always an easy topic because individuals do believe that if I don't use it, why should I fund it? But we really are all funding transportation in one way or the other.
Peter on Perkins. Peter, good morning. You're on the air with Tara Wicker. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I've got a question. I believe in the service. I don't need it. I'm doing very well all around. In the assets we purchased, who owns buses, who owns the assets, can they be purchased by a private investor at cost, at minimal cost? And let business step in and run it.
All right. What about privatizing the whole thing?
Not averse to that. If, you know, there's a private industry that would be able to come in and actually run this system and run it in a way that people would still be able to afford it and be able to get to work and serve that same purpose. I'm not averse to that at all.
Well, it goes straight to downtown New Orleans. Both communities benefit from this. But my guess is that more people commute from Baton Rouge to New Orleans than the other way around, although there are some who obviously do come to Baton Rouge.
You're right. I would consider that to be a fact. I mean, I pass by there every morning, and literally, it's packed with people going to New Orleans. My hope is that as Baton Rouge grows and our economy grows, it will be in the reverse as well. We'll have just as many people coming from New Orleans to go to work here in Baton Rouge. But we do know that there's a large population that is leaving Baton Rouge, either individuals that were formerly from New Orleans that are going back to New Orleans to work, or individuals that are here that saw an opportunity in New Orleans and took advantage of that.
Robert at LSU writes that if Governor Jindal can have his transportation paid for when he goes to New Orleans and back, the rest of us should as well.
Wow, that's a very interesting comment. I do understand the rationale behind that. You know, again, for me, I think it goes down to making sure that the economics and the citizens are taken care of. Anytime that you're able to get people to work, and you mentioned it so wonderfully earlier, Jim, that it's much easier for us to have people working than people that are unemployed on the street. And if we're able to get them to work and make sure that it's helping the economy and helping the community, I think we should be involved in doing that. Governor Jindal and his transportation issues, I don't really have a comment on that.
Well, also, when people come to Baton Rouge from New Orleans or the other way around, they're generally going down there to participate in economic endeavors. They're shopping, they're attending some event, or they're going to work. They're not going down there usually just to loiter. So in that case, it's an economic driver, isn't it?
It definitely is. And again, I think that was to the earlier point about having New Orleans and Baton Rouge and, you know, those parishes in between to participate, because as individuals are traveling back and forth, both of those cities are definitely benefiting from those individuals spending money, working, and boosting the economy. So we need to be able to come together as two communities that are getting closer and closer and making sure that we both participate in this.
Edwin writes, do I recall correctly that Governor Jindal declined federal money to establish a rail service between Baton Rouge and New Orleans? That was $12 million a year, if I remember right, and the governor decided that it was not a worthy endeavor.
Right. You know, I know there was a lot of discussion regarding that. My personal belief is that I do believe that we need a rail system in between New Orleans and Baton Rouge. Again, I think that the overall impact that it will have on both cities, I think we still have not seen that. And if we have an opportunity to allow people easier transportation between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, I think there are lessons that we can definitely learn and pull from New Orleans and utilize them here in Baton Rouge. I think we'll be in a much better position.
Well, where does that stand right now as far as that objective? Is that goal off the table now, or is it still permeating?
I think there's a groundswell of people that are at the grassroots level that are definitely not going to let that thing die. I know that there's a regional transportation group that has been actively working. They've been putting together conferences and workshops to talk about the reality of that happening, talking in the business community. So it's definitely not off the table.
297-5633 in our remaining moments with Councilwoman Tara Wicker. And before she leaves, I did want to note that she's involved in something that's helpful to young people in our community. Children, kids between the ages of 3 and 18 without insurance have a chance to receive dental service. How is that working?
We are very excited. We actually have facility at the Leo S. Butler Center at 950 East Washington, and we had some space available. Historically, had a dental clinic there. It left, and it was no longer there. I was driving down the street one day, literally saw Smile Louisiana on the back of a mobile unit. Called them, and they agreed to come and set up to provide services to kids through those ages in the Butler Center. And it's been phenomenal. It's been absolutely great. We're very excited about it. I hope we can keep them.
Well, available services include an exam and x-rays, prevention such as cleaning fluoride sealants and fillings, and six-month recall and follow-up care, oral hygiene, and case management instruction. And it's 8 to 4 p.m. Monday through Thursday at the Leo S. Butler Center, 950 East Washington Street. I guess that's in your district.
That is. That's our community center. And people are very excited. They've been there doing excellent work. And we just want to make sure that individuals are aware of this sort of hidden treasure that's out there that's available, especially in preparation for children going back to school.
And for more information, you can call the District 10 Council Office, led by Councilwoman Wicker, 225-389-5140. You live in an area that is afflicted with crime and represent it. How is the effort to curb crime going?
You know, we have been, I guess, fortunate and unfortunate in a sense that the BRAVE initiative have recently expanded into the 70802 area, which is that South Baton Rouge, mid-city area. We actually have what's called a police and community together meeting every fourth Thursday at the Butler Center. And so they come out and talk to the community about ways that the community can actually get involved. I personally believe that, you know, crime is a community issue. It's not a police issue. We have to be able to be in a position of changing the way that we react and respond to crime in our communities in order to make sure that the police are able to do their jobs effectively.
Cy on North Boulevard. Cy, you're on the air with Tara Wicker. Good morning, Cy.
Ms. Wicker, I passed by North 19th every day, and there's a burned-out building there that's been burned out, two-story building, burned out for like 2 or 3 years, and nothing's been done by the city to remove it. You know about that building? It's in your district.
I'm very familiar with it. When was the last time you... Oh.
I passed by today. I passed by every day. And it's now it's fallen in, but it's got, you know, it's really just a horrible thing for the neighbors there. The people who live in that neighborhood are just abused by having to see that every day. If anything you could do about it would be great. Thank you. I'll take my ass off here.
Thank you, Cy.
I totally agree with you. That building was burned, and actually we were asked to allow them to tear it down themselves. We gave them a moment to do that, and it was actually last year, but now the building is being demolished. I passed by there this morning, as a matter of fact, and it's just about all the way down. They're in the process now of removing that debris, but I agree with you. It was way too long that it stood there. We were trying to give them an opportunity to get it down themselves, but it is down and definitely will no longer be an eyesore in that area.
The building's right across from the old book warehouse, I think.
It really is.
And it's come down bit by bit, but Cy's right. It's an eyesore, and I would imagine people who live in that area don't like having that eyesore in their midst.
You're right. It was kind of a frustrating thing for us as well, because we did give the individuals an opportunity to tear it down. And once we found out that that was not happening, it started coming on down. And hopefully within the next week, that debris will be removed.
What's the biggest issue right now that your constituents are contacting you about?
Mostly, you know, everybody's concerned about crime issues and making sure that the community is safe, but also beautification is another thing. People are excited about moving forward with the city, making sure that the community looks like it's supposed to, and individuals are able to enjoy their quality of life. So we've spent a lot of time organizing communities, cleaning up vacant lots, removing abandoned houses, and trying to get the community back into commerce.
Is there any chance you'll run for mayor in a few years?
You know, I've been asked that question quite a bit. We are prayerfully considering that. For me, it's more of, it's a good idea for me to run. But when the community, average everyday citizens will come to me and say, Tara, you know, we really want you to represent us. We think that you'll do a great job. For me, that's more of a statement of, yes, you should do this. I have 5 kids. My goal is to make sure that young people in this community have an opportunity to really select Baton Rouge as a place to live, work, and raise their kids. And if me rolling up my sleeves, getting into that race allows that to happen, then I'll consider.
Well, we wish you well. How old are your children, Tara?
My oldest is 17 and my youngest is 1.
Jeez, so you've had a busy 16 years.
I have a good span, a good grasp on what young people need. So I definitely think we can look at it from all different angles.
Well, we wish you well and look forward to a return visit very soon. Thank you, Councilwoman
it.
Wicker.
Thank
Always
you so
pleasure.
Much.
Take care. 297-5633-877-217-5757. Those are your numbers. And we're joined now by Daniel Bergner. His book is literally The Talk of the Nation, What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. Front page of the New York Times Book Review yesterday and a few weeks ago, featured in the New York Times Magazine section. Good morning to you, Daniel Bergner.
Good morning, Jim. It's nice to be on the show.
Well, nice to talk with you. And I recall visiting with you well over a decade ago on the air. And at that time, you'd written a book about Angola.
Yes. You know, lots of fond memories of being on the show, of writing that book. And, you know, Louisiana is probably my favorite state after New York. Been back many times since. So it's great to talk with you.
Well, this book, I'm sure even you are surprised at the attention it is receiving. And first of all, how does a man write a book called What Do Women Want? Is that a bit presumptuous, Daniel Bergner?
Well, I definitely worried, still worry about that, worry that it's strange, worry that it's arrogant. Finally, I just hope it's neither of those. I spent a lot of time listening, I'd say 8 years worth of listening, both side by side with women scientists in their labs, and then interviewing scores of women, some of whose stories I tell in the book about their sexual lives. So it was really, in a sense, the rare journalistic project where you come to it in a full state of not knowing and try to go from there. So what fills the book is women's voices.
Well, the general consensus is that men are more prone to promiscuity than women. Your research challenges that.
I really do challenge that. So as you say, we've long been taught by evolutionary psychologists most recently that, you know, men are programmed by evolution to spread their seed, to be promiscuous, and women to more or less seek out one good man and thus be more suited to monogamy. I think science is now giving us a very different, ultimately empowering vision of women's sexuality. And one of the things I confronted almost right away is that when it comes to sex, monogamy may be at least as much of a problem, maybe more so for women than for men.
Well, we're going to talk with Daniel Bergner about this, and you can understand why his research is getting much attention. He's contending, Daniel Bergner is, that women may be more prone to promiscuity than men. We'll talk about it. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. The book is What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. Gay Talese says Daniel Bergner has written a keenly intelligent book about a subject that often exceeds our intelligence. What do women want? Back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing. Our guest is Daniel Bergner. Now a prolific writer, his latest work is What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. His first work was God of the Rodeo, The Quest for Redemption in Louisiana's Angola Prison. And that, as we noted, has been over a decade ago. And since then, Daniel has tackled some tough topics. And this one is tough in that people have opinions which are quite possibly being challenged by his research. When you started this this endeavor, did you have preconceived notions that were challenged by your own research?
Yes, very much so. I think they started with this idea that men are naturally the more promiscuous gender. They started with sort of all kinds of societal assumptions that we have that I think my reporting, the work of women scientists, are starting to turn upside down. So I'll just give you a couple examples of things I ran into right away that began to sort of change my way of seeing and that I hope will start a conversation as people read the book. So Meredith Chivers, first scientist I spent time with, does some fascinating comparisons between what women say turns them on and what their bodies say using a little device called the plethysmograph. And she, in one comparison, a very handsome stranger on the one hand, and equally handsome, trusted, close friend on the other. Women say the trusted, close friend is the bigger turn-on. Women's bodies say something else entirely. And that was just the beginning of a kind of wake-up call. Another set of studies looked at desire within committed relationships, within marriages. And desire for both men and women starts out at around the same point. For men, it declines kind of gradually. For women, much more steeply. And it was kind of evidence like this that began to sort of take the blinders off and make me think, are we thinking about women's desire in the right way? We so assume that it depends on intimacy, on emotional closeness, on long attachment. And I think that may be a kind of convenient myth for us men. It's very comforting to think that while we naturally roam in our thoughts anyway, that women are more or less geared to, you know, sticking close by us. And I'm not at all sure that's true. And again, I hope the book really starts a candid conversation between men and women about this.
Well, I'm sure you're opening up some subjects that people are uncomfortable with. For example, based on reading your book, I would come away with the impression that for people who've been married for a long time, your research indicates that the biggest way to kill a woman's sex drive is to be monogamous.
Yeah, I have to say that that is what I was hearing again and again from individual women and as well from scientists. So one story I tell in the book is that of Passy. She's a very proper 58-year-old Southern woman who I spent a lot of time with. She loves her husband mightily, but has long been coming up against the feeling that something's missing in her sexual life. And I think for more women than maybe we men are willing to hear about, and for more women that are willing to fully talk about it, there is this choice between kind of putting aside the sexual, the erotic, and just saying that's not important to me, which I think women have basically been taught to do, or kind of confronting those feelings that don't necessarily fit so easily into the box of monogamy. Now, I should say, I'm pretty much of a romantic. I'm in a monogamous relationship. I don't think so many of us are going to throw away monogamy too quickly. It's too important to us. It's about love. It's about security. But then the question comes, how can a candid conversation about our feelings lead us toward some better place than the place of feeling like we just don't have any more a full sexual self within our committed relationships?
What do women want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire from Daniel Bergner, who is a brave man. How long have you been in your relationship, Daniel?
Well, we're approaching 4.5 years on this one, so I'd say I am not yet a veteran like the people I was writing about. That, you know, even so, given what I was looking at in terms of the science, I often look at my partner and say, you know, how much more of your desire am I going to have left? How many more months? And it's kind of a running joke between us. But it's also, I should say, it's kind of a nice thing because, you know, part of us wants unconditional love from our partners, wants to know we'll be loved and secure and feel desire from that person no matter what. But maybe the saner place and the better place is to acknowledge that the love we get from our partners is not really unconditional. It's not the love we get from our parents. And, you know, we kind of need to earn that love and earn that desire every day. And, you know, maybe that's a healthier way to sustain desire within monogamy.
Well, men for centuries have been rather complacent about their significant others being there forever, but that's changing now, especially with women in many cases earning more than their spouses, having more assets, How is the economic engine driving sexual attitudes and beliefs in this country?
Well, two things that might sound a bit contradictory, but I don't think they are. So on the one hand, I still feel strongly there's a double standard about sex when it comes to men and women. We are seen to be in a sexually unrestrained society. I don't think that's so with women. Much more burden is placed on them to be, you know, more restrained, more modest, more limited in their sexuality, while we expect men to be promiscuous, as we've been saying. That's on the one hand. On the other, I do think that increasing equality when it comes to income, increasing power for women in the workforce, is somehow linked up to this understanding that I'm putting forward in the book, this more candid exploration of female desire. You know, I'd like to think this is all my ingenious brainchild, but of course it's not. The research that's now going on is all part of a social movement, I think, toward being willing to see women as, you know, as full beings, as powerful parts of our society. And I think the more we're willing to honestly talk about that, the better off we'll all be.
Well, here are some of the findings, and we'll go through these quickly. In a recent experiment, psychologist Terry Fisher asked hundreds of college-age men and women how many sexual partners they'd had. Half the participants were wired to a fake polygraph. The men's answers were the same whether or not they were hooked up to the lie detector. But for the women who were hooked up, their reported number of sexual partners was 70% higher. What do you make of this?
Well, exactly what the researcher makes of it, which is that there is still so much societal pressure on women to diminish their sexuality in one way or another. As she puts it, you know, there's one gender, men, males, who are much more allowed by society to be sexual than women are.
We've long considered testosterone to be a driver for sexual and other kinds of aggression. Men have 7 to 10 times more testosterone than women. Pop psychology tells us this makes us inherently much more prone to chase after sex, but look again at female monkeys. Their testosterone levels are as low as women's, yet the females chase the males, initiate almost all of the sex, and the generals and the assault squads in warfare, and are the generals and assault squads in warfare. Testosterone was thought to be a major component in pursuit of sexual activity. You're saying maybe not.
I'm saying testosterone's important, but the picture is very complex. We've latched onto this very simple idea. Testosterone equals sex drive, thus men have greater sex drive. Just not so. It was almost funny to watch the monkeys. I spent quite a lot of time at the Primatology Center. You know, and for those of us who put any credence at all in evolutionary relevance, to see our close ancestors and their patterns of sexuality was really interesting. So for so long, primatologists have had us believe that males are the aggressors in the monkey kingdom, that males are the sexual initiators. Take the blinders off, watch what happens as we get nearer and nearer to sex, and it's the women, or rather I should say the females, who are doing the sexual stalking really dramatically now, and then who are, you know, the objectifiers in sex, who are objectifying their objects of desire. And then finally, and here's the real kicker, so primatologists have to cycle out, have to get rid of the males in their compounds every 2 to 3 years because the females are too bored to have sex with them anymore. So it's funny, but it's also, you know, it can tell you an awful lot about what lies right beneath our societal veils.
Hugh at LSU. Hugh, good morning. You're on the air with Daniel Bergner, author of What Do Women Want? Hi, Hugh.
Hi, Daniel. Listen, let me ask you a question. What do you think about a woman's rights to choose in terms of abortion and that issue? What are your feelings on that?
All right. I don't know that that's particularly relevant to this topic, but it may be. What do you think, Daniel?
You know, I'm going to say two things. One, I think ultimately it is of course, relevant. We're talking about sexuality. We're talking about reproduction. Inevitably, those things are intertwined. But I fear that if we go down that path this morning, we are going to lose sight of what's important here just in the realm of desire. You know, they are separable. I really did write this book about desire. That's where the expertise lies. So can we leave it at that for this morning, even though I acknowledge that the two things are interlinked?
All right. But for couples who have been together, men and women, for maybe 10, 20, 30 years or more, and they're making love at the same time, same place, same way, your research indicates that the man is much more likely to be content with this than the female, the woman.
Let me explain why. I think ultimately, biologically, each sex is probably about equally happy or thwarted within that situation. But here's just a further explanation and then maybe a suggestion. So men have a luxury in our society. We are fantasizing freely, checking out this woman and that at work and on the street, and we bring home some of that energy, right? And not only that, but, you know, one chapter of my book really goes inside sort of the neurology, the brain paths of desire. And our brain paths of desire, sure enough, get strengthened almost like a muscle by all that fantasizing. So we bring all that home. Women, because of the double standard, you know, I'm not naive. I know women do, of course, think about sex throughout the day, but not as much. And it's funny that the luxury men have is, even though things might get a little less exciting within a monogamous relationship, men bring home that energy more of it, I think, than women do. And here's where the sort of solution comes in. This may sound kind of counterintuitive, but were women given that permission as much as men, I think that men would, in a sense, be the beneficiaries, because there's all that erotic energy that would come their way even inside of monogamous relationships.
Betsy asks if men are less likely than women to be promiscuous, why is the drug industry spending so much in a quest to find a female Viagra drug?
Right, and I think that really does, it's a smart question, I think that really does have to do with the situation of monogamy. I think the market for the female desire drug will be primarily for women in monogamous relationships. It's sort of, and this overstates it a little, but basically, I think it's true, that drug will be a cure for women for monogamy, and that's why those drug makers will be so very rich.
But men of a certain age who use Viagra, some might think they'd be more prone to be promiscuous than less.
You know, it's interesting. I think if I'm understanding the question, the you know, one thing that's important to point out is that although we call the female desire drug a female Viagra, it's really something very different. It's going into the brain. It's meddling with the sort of pathways of desire, whereas, of course, Viagra is a much more physical, simple, mechanical kind of drug. And again, what the female desire drug is doing is just making desire more accessible so that within a monogamous relationship, say, if things aren't that thrilling anymore, it just makes lust come a little bit more easily.
Some fascinating insights from Daniel Bergner from his research, including the role of narcissism in female desire.
Yeah, you know, narcissism is a tricky word, and I would emphasize that the researcher who talked a lot about that uses that word descriptively and not in a critical way. But you spoke over and over again about the power of the desire to be desired for women. And I found that so compelling. I think lots of women I spoke to, lots of women whose stories I tell, talked about that. There was one woman in particular whose story I tell, 30-year-old woman trying to decide whether to marry a man, very attractive, adoring man, but from whom maybe she didn't feel that kind of uncontrollable, fierce force of desire coming at her that can be so electric. And that always stuck with me. And so, yes, I think that is a spark of desire that the book explores quite a bit.
Well, it's an amazing work and has been received as such. What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire from a Man, Daniel Bergner. Lastly, Daniel, why did you go down this path?
You know, I couldn't, in a way, I couldn't help it. I came into Meredith Shivers' lab, and she was doing such fascinating research. And then, of course, as a man, you know, on a personal level, you know, what else do we want to know as badly as this? So I think it was both the scientific and the personal that came together. And again, I just hope that the book starts a really intense and fascinating conversation.
All right. Thank you, Daniel. Thanks for listening, everybody. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.